Coming up on today's program, we can't wait to tell you about an NPR quiz show coming to town. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISA Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. Coming up later in the program, we'll chat with WISO's newest employee, already a familiar voice, Lee Wade. We've got Bird Note and Today from the Ohio Newsroom. Up first, you may have heard that WISO is bringing NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me to the Rose Music Center on September 3rd. Their last visit was in 2017. There are still general admission tickets on sale, and you can get two VIP tickets when you donate to WISO using the form on our website. The VIP tickets get you guaranteed seating in the pit section close to the stage and admission to a reception after the show where you have the opportunity to meet the Wait, Wait panelists from the evening show and host Peter Sagal, who I had the honor of speaking with this week. Check this out. Peter, thanks for doing this. It's a real honor to speak with you. You are coming to Dayton for what, like the fourth time?
Yeah, but not for a while. I think the last time, if I remember correctly, was something like 6 or 7 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. But weirdly and quite happily, as far as I remember, some of our very first shows on the road, which way back when were the only shows we did in front of a live audience, were in the Dayton area. We came a bunch of times. Partially because our producer at the time, Rod Abid, who tragically passed away this spring, was an Ohio native, and he loved to go home. So some of our very first and happiest experiences in front of a live audience were in the Dayton area.
And what prompted the decision to take the show on the road?
Well, it's a slightly complicated story, but also kind of a simple one. The complicated version is that our show was designed by our creator, Doug Berman, the same guy who gave the world Car Talk, working with NPR, to be a studio show. And it had a lot of reasons why that was such a good idea. One was you have a national talent pool. You don't have to fly anybody in. You just put them in studios, connect the studios. Secondly, the sound quality was such that you could edit it, which is a big thing with Mr. Berman. He likes to edit things to make them sound as good as possible. The studio makes that a lot easier. And so that's how the show was set up. But here's the simple reason why we moved to a live format eventually, or rather, I should say, in front of a live audience. If you have an audience for a comedy show, they might laugh, which is good. It sounds good, and it incentivizes the performers to be funnier because people might laugh. You know, it's like dolphin and herring. And the way it happened was purely, well, I'd say by accident, but it was more like somebody else had the idea. We got a call from a guy who ran a station in Salt Lake City, not the major station there, a smaller one that is now no longer, saying, look, we think it'd be really fun to have you do our show for us. In front of an audience that we'll provide. We'll give you everything. We'll get you hotels. We'll get you airplane tickets. We'll set it up for you. Just come on out and do it for us. And we were like, okay, seems easy. So we did it. And that was in January of 2000, just about 2 years almost exactly since the show premiered on the air. And it was like this amazing success. Remember what I said about people laughing? And so as soon as that was broadcast, every other station, including YSO and Dayton, started getting in touch and saying, like, oh, would you come and do it for us? And so we started doing these shows on the road every month eventually. And it was just so obvious the show was so much better in front of a live audience, which, by the way, seems obvious in retrospect, that in 2004, we started moving to all live audience taping. And that's what we've been doing ever since.
You have normally done indoor venues, I think, but more recently, outdoor venues?
We've done both. One of the things about my life that makes me think that I'm just in the middle of some sort of weird dream that I will eventually wake up from is that our show and me and my colleagues and friends have played some of the premier outdoor music venues in America, including Tanglewood and Wolf Trap in Virginia, near Washington, and most surreally, and I use that word advisedly, Red Rocks. We played Red Rocks, you know, me, Bono in the Rain, the big signs of, you know, the big iconic images of Red Rocks. We've also played one big outdoor venue up near Cleveland, I think called Blossom, the Blossom Music Center. And so this is not entirely new for us. We just, in fact, played an outdoor venue in Sonoma, California, the Green Music Center. And it's great fun. I love it. weather's nice. People, you know, people bring picnics, and there's nothing, you know, we don't have like 2-drink minimums in public radio. But if people bring, you know, nice bottles of an inexpensive but charming Chardonnay, that has the same effect, and the audience is even that much more receptive to what we're doing.
Well, the Wait Wait crew is going to be live at Rose Music Center on September 3rd. It's a great outdoor venue. We'll hopefully have plenty of people there. Let's talk a little bit about the format of the show. There's a lot of serious news happening in the world.
Isn't there? I hadn't noticed.
Yeah. Why do you think it's important to present it, some of it, in a funny, not so serious way?
The best way to answer it is I don't know if I'd be able to have gotten through the last, decade or so with my sanity intact if I wasn't able to do the radio show and make dumb jokes about the dumb aspects of the week's news. So speaking for myself, it's been an essential survival tool, but and I imagine it has some of that same effect for the listeners, or that's what they tell me. I mean, I think we're all, you know, we're all public radio people here, right? I'm a public radio person. You're a public radio person. Everybody listening to us right now is a public radio person. And when we take things seriously, we public radio people, we listen to the news, we make sure that we're informed. Sometimes it feels like a serious civic duty to be informed and listen to our, you know, public radio stations and my colleagues at NPR News. And so we just need a break, don't you think? Once in a while, maybe an hour a week, to get goofy and stupid and make dad jokes and poop jokes and say rude things about important people, just to let off some steam or provide a distraction. God knows, I really, like I said, it's been my lifeline in an otherwise sometimes very bleak news environment. So I assume it provides that for the audience as well.
On September 3rd, the audience will get a chance to see really what happens behind the scenes before the fully produced show is released. And can you, I know they're going to see it for themselves, but can you describe a little bit of how it goes?
Well, our show, I mean, again, two ways of looking at it. One way is it's pretty much our show that you hear in the radio. We record our show live to tape. It's not like we're doing anything weird, you know, some strange, you know, guess the picture segment that only the live audience can see. But on the other hand, we routinely record at least 90 minutes of material that gets edited down to the about 52 minutes of radio show or podcast that people hear. So that's slightly less than twice as much material. And a lot of that material is great, but we just can't broadcast it, partially because we don't have room, sometimes because if we did broadcast it, we'd all be arrested. That used to be a joke. I don't know if it is anymore. There's a lot of stuff that happens on stage that we never anticipate and is amazing and surprising, and only our audience who have come to see us live will ever know about. For example, I just mentioned we did a show in Sonoma, California. One of our panelists talked about a sideline she had, a little bit of extra work. Well, perfectly legal, I should say. I can't tell you about it because we're on the radio now. So the reason that we couldn't broadcast it on our radio show is the same reason I can't tell you about it now. And only the people who came to see us in Sonoma a couple of weeks ago will ever know about that. It'll be something they'll carry with them for the rest of their lives. I guarantee you there must be one person who was there who might be listening to this, and they are laughing their heads off right now because it was amazing. One thing people may or may not know about our show is, although we have a very wonderful writing staff who I work with every week to come up with stories to talk about and jokes to make about those stories and all kinds of other things, our show is still very much improvisational. Our panelists, for the most part, have no idea what we're going to ask them. I have no idea what they're going to say. Certainly that's true of our special guest as well. And so nobody quite knows what's ever going to happen when we start our show. Even though we have a plan, part of our intent is for that to go off the rails. And it always does. And so coming to see us is one way to find out what really happens when there is no, you know, editor involved.
Let's jump back for a bit, if you don't mind, and tell us how you got involved with the program.
Dumb luck. Absolutely dumb luck. I do not deserve it in any way. I'm just, if people were to take my career as an example of how to proceed, basically you do something else for a long time and then one day the phone would ring and someone would pretty much just offer you your dream job out of nowhere, and then you'd have it. which is not too much of an exaggeration. I did mention that the show was invented, created by Doug Berman, famous for Car Talk and other things, who NPR hired to create this new comedy show, this comedy news quiz for NPR, now going back on 30 years ago. And he put the show together. It was not me. People say, oh, is this something you always wanted to do? And I used to lie and say, yeah, I was always a quiz guy. You know, I created my own major in college, quiz show studies. No, I was just this guy. I was a writer writing plays and screenplays when I got a phone call from somebody I knew saying, hey, would you like to be a part of this new show on NPR? I think you'd be good for it. Okay, great. So I put my name in. I got a call. I auditioned on the phone. I was a panelist on this brand new show that broadcast, that first broadcast in January of 1998, called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It was, shall we say, a work in progress, I think, to be polite. And one of the things that Doug and his collaborators at the time decided they needed to do to make progress was to find a new host. So with time pressure extraordinarily and pressure from the stations, people may or may not know this, but every station in the public radio system, YSO, everyone else, makes their own decisions about what they're going to broadcast at any given moment of the day. There's no like, you know, NPR doesn't say, okay, now everybody has to broadcast this, and everybody says yes or no. It's all independent. It's all individual decisions. And some stations had chosen independently to broadcast this new show. Their audiences weren't thrilled. They weren't thrilled. They felt like they had put themselves out there to, you know, bring this new show to their audiences. They needed something to happen quick, all which means that with no other options immediately available and no time to find new ones, they turned to me and asked me to be the host. And I was like, sure, I could host a public radio show. How hard could that be? Geez, I mean, I hear these people do it all the time. So I did, and I moved to Chicago to become the host in May 1998, thinking, eh, this will be fun for a few years before I move on to my next, you know, whatever. And here I am, almost 30 years later, talking to you about it.
And you've been able to work with some great co-hosts, scorekeepers, judges,
yep,
and panelists, Carl Castle. I bet there are still answering machines out there with Carl's voice on them.
I hear from people every now and then. They say, I want you to know I have Carl's voice in my answering machine, or voicemail or whatever it may be. We go back so long, we actually used to send out cassette tapes, ladies and gentlemen. That's how old we are, which people still have. I don't know how they play them. No wax cylinders, as far as I know. And all I want to do when people tell me that is call them so I can hear Carl's voice. In fact, we've been doing this thing for NPR Plus. People who donate a little extra get access to audio and material and fun extra things. And one of them is a game where we go back and we ask a new person questions that we asked a listener contestant 20 years ago. And I get to hear Carl's voice. And I miss him. He was wonderful. I've gotten to work now with three amazing judge and scorekeepers. Again, never saw that coming, but here we are.
Yeah, you're working with Alzo?
Alzo Slade, who just took over in May of this year. I should say April, I think. No, wait a minute. June was his first term. Carl, so confusing. Yes, I said, I'm getting old myself. Bill Curtis, our second amazing judge and scorekeeper, retired from the post at the end of May. And Alzo Slade, the newest, took over in the beginning of June. And he's great. It's funny though, when we welcomed Alzo at a private event, and I said, this is going to be so weird. It's going to be so strange after so many years to be doing the show without an elderly white man on stage. And everybody looked at me and I was like, oh, so at least we're continuing that tradition one way or another.
Any insights looking back over the 30 years about the evolution of the program?
You know, the show has in many ways stayed the same. The elements of the show, first what was once Who's Carl this time is now Who's Alzo this time. The Listener Limerick Challenge, invented by a producer named Leslie Fuller way back in 98, still there. And so that's the same, and I think that's good. People love, in radio in particular, they love stability, they love predictability, they want to hear the things that we normally do, the things that they've been tuned in, just like they used to tune in to Car Talk to hear them talk about cars. If they started talking about elephants, it wouldn't have been the same show. But the way that we've changed, and I say this in all humility, because I have depended on it, is we have refreshed and improved and renewed our cast of characters. And I mean that both on stage, our panelists, and backstage. I work with an array of wonderful people, just about all of whom are younger than I am, all of whom are funnier than I am, and many of whom have perspectives and opinions and ideas that I just don't have. And if this show, God forbid, relied just on what I, Peter Sagal, had to say about anything, it would have faded into oblivion, deservedly so, decades ago. The reason the show is interesting is because whenever I am on stage, as I will be at the Rose, and look to my left, stage left, I see three delightful people who are, again, funnier and more talented and more entertaining than I'll ever be. And now when I look to my right, I see Alzo Slade, who is all of those things and more. And that's, to me, what keeps the show. Basically, I'm the ringmaster. And if you want to ask why the circus has been going on so long, it's because the acts are so good. I'm just the guy pointing at them.
The acts are great, but you do a great job of playing off the fine senses of humor that are collected on stage. Coming back to the Rose Music Center on September 3rd, the entire cast of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and you can find out the information on our website. Peter Sagal, it has been a pleasure to speak with you.
It's my pleasure, and I'm looking forward to seeing everybody who's listening. And if you think I'm talking about you, I am. I mean you specifically. I'm not going to name you because I don't want to make you get any awkward questions about how we know each other. But yes, I am very much looking forward to seeing you specifically at the Rose, so please come on out.
Thank you so much. We can't wait to see you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
And again, we've got ticket information on our website at wyso.org. And we know you'll have a great, memorable time. Reserve your general admission or VIP tickets today before another busy week takes us all by surprise. Coming up, we've got Bird Note and a conversation with WISO's Lee Wade up next. It's Today from the Ohio Newsroom.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom, an Ohio drug court takes the screen.
Support comes from Ohio CASA. Ohio CASA's mission is to ensure children experiencing abuse and neglect have a caring, trained adult in their corner. Information about CASA volunteer work is at ohiocasa.org.
I'm Erin Gottsacker. Many films have set out to capture the crisis of drug or alcohol addiction, but far fewer have focused on the long, uneven process of recovery. A filmmaker with Ohio ties has turned his lens on that often overlooked journey. The Ohio Newsroom's Kendall Crawford reports.
For the last decade, the Adult Recovery Court in Bell Fountain has met every Monday to aid people with addiction who are coming out of the criminal justice system. The court helps them find jobs, housing, and transportation. Logan County Common Pleas Court Judge Keith Bragg says it's not exactly cinematic.
Nothing's blowing up and nobody's rescuing anybody.
And yet, earlier this winter, Bragg watched his program and himself on the silver screen at the Sundance Film Festival.
So today is Cody's first day, so let's all make sure that we give him a nice warm welcome.
In the film Union County, Cody Parsons is navigating drug court for the first time.
I'm Cody and I'm an addict.
Hi, Cody.
I've been addicted to opiates since I was 17.
The story follows Cody and his brother as they work toward recovery. And while they are fictional creations played by Will Poulter and Noah Centineo respectively, their stories are interwoven with documentary footage of Bragg's drug court, where real participants share weekly dispatches on getting sober.
I got to spend Saturday and Sunday with my family. I got to see my kids, and they were really excited. And so I did like a little treasure hunt for my kids for them to find their Easter baskets, and I made them follow the eggs.
Director Adam Meeks created this blend of documentary and fiction after visiting family in central Ohio and watching a drug court meeting for the first time.
I was just completely blown away by the, like, empathy and humanity in that room and this kind of community showing up for itself.
So he spent years getting to know them and the people running the drug court, like court administrator Annette Dio. She plays herself in the movie, fighting tirelessly to counsel the brothers through relapse.
I'm going to do everything I can for you and for Jack to help you guys get through this.
Dio just happened to have 4 years of theater school under her belt. But the role wasn't exactly a stretch. Cody's story closely reflects the experience of the people she works with every day.
It shows so much dignity for the people in recovery. You know, one of the things I've worked in with my career is really working against the stigma of someone with a substance use disorder is a bad person. And they're not. They have a bad problem.
Rather than dwelling on people's mistakes, the movie lingers on mundane moments, cleaning up balloons after the program's graduation ceremony, performing drug tests in front of court personnel. Meek says its pace mirrors the journey of recovery.
Like, that's also the thing that the character's up against when trying to figure out how to, like, fill the time and their life and find a certain kind of day-to-day, moment-to-moment fulfillment without using.
Meeks hopes that this intimate portrayal can shift people's perception of rural Ohio from bleak to blossoming.
This is also about pointing the camera towards a place that I thought was kind of underappreciated or like misrepresented and being like, look how beautiful this is.
Judge Bragg says the fact that people care enough to set up cameras in his courtroom at all has already inspired hope for his participants. He started to use the film as an example of the joys that can come from sober life.
If you just show up every day and do what you're supposed to do, something good will find you, and it might even be a movie star.
The film is playing in theaters starting today. But for members of Bragg's Court and many like it across the state and the country, there's a sequel every week. For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Kendall Crawford.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you on Monday.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Very pleased to be with you this weekend and very pleased to have someone in the studio with us. It is WYSO's newest staff member, Lee Wade. Lee, welcome.
Yes, happy weekend.
So, newest staff member, you've been involved with the station for a couple years now through fellowships and volunteer work, part-time work, but you have just been hired full-time in the Community Voices division of WYSO. So what is your official title?
Yeah, my official title is editor and community audio producer.
And that's nice. So let's go back a little ways. You are the producer of Translucent, a series that has gone through several seasons now. Tell us about that.
I started working on the project back in 2023 for a class project of mine, learning how to podcast. And at the moment, I wasn't thinking that it would turn into a series, but more of like, I just wanted to create a story to share with people. So like that first story that I worked on was an interview between my dad and I just a few weeks after he returned home from prison. And then me like, you know, basically just like sticking a microphone in his face to ask him about, you know, like what he thinks of my transition since he came back home. And you know, later on down the line, I saw that the Community Voices class was opening up, and so I pitched a series of the same concept, but just wanting to educate listeners about what it's like to be trans, non-binary, or gender non-conforming, and bringing in people here locally just to share their own stories to educate people. And so yeah, Translucent is a audio journalism project podcast. Basically just highlighting the trans community's wins and, you know, some of the things that the current administration is throwing at us and just talking about how those things are impacting us locally, but, you know, kind of adding a global scope to it because these are things that people are dealing with, you know, nationwide.
What does it mean to you to be able to start with a very personal story and then have that turn into additional conversations with other people throughout the trans community and allies?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't even think I have like all the words to explain, but yeah, it feels good to you know, to hear feedback from people like, you know, your story is something that I can relate to, or like stories that I've produced with other people on the podcast. You know, people are learning how to be better parents, how to be better allies, and even how to like accept their own self. So that really means a lot, and it really can't be done without like the help of, you know, other people and like other people wanting to be brave and share their stories publicly as well.
You've learned a lot about production and audio through creating your own stories and the Translucent series, but now you're going to be working with other people on their projects as editor and community audio producer. Tell us how excited are you to be doing that?
I'm really excited. You know, I think it's a privilege to be motivated or like excited about something and then see that turn into something. And now, you know, just being underneath Will Davis's wing to learn about, you know, his own editing techniques and you know, tools and things like that he has to offer has been helpful. And so I'm pretty much happy and you know, like excited to, you know, hopefully provide those same tools and things to people who may have an idea but haven't messed around with audio equipment or you know how to put a podcast together.
You're doing some news stuff occasionally for the newsroom as well, so mm-hmm. you're kind of got a foot in all the doors here.
Yeah, yeah. I think you know that's a good way to kind of learn how the station works and just collaborate a little bit. Yeah, today I was out in Dayton at Daybreak reporting on a story. They just got a huge grant from Lowe's to add another wing to their campus. So yeah, working on stories for the news department helps me exercise like some of those same skills, and you know, so I'm not showing up rusty.
Yeah. Because it's not just audio; it's writing, it's producing. You know, it's actually thinking of you know kind of what you want as far as end results, and then working toward that. So that's enough about work, but we do these interviews with staff members just so listeners can get to know who they're supporting here at the station and so we can get to know each other as well because we're all busy getting our work done throughout the day. So tell me a little bit more about yourself. I always ask because music is also a big component of what WISO does. Are you into music? Do you play any instruments?
Oh, yeah. I'm a big music head. I kind of grew up in a musical family, but yeah, I like a mixture of, you know, different genres, but lately I've been really into like alternative rap, a little bit of jazz, hip hop, rap, listening to music. People may not be happy with me after saying this, but Spotify, I have like 20 hours active on Spotify during the week. So there's always something in the background playing.
Ah, no, that's quite all right. And so tell me a little bit about your family. Siblings, are you a Dayton area native?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I grew up in West Dayton, was a product of the Dayton Public Schools. And then, so yeah, I'm not too far from home. I chose to go to Antioch. It's pretty close. But yeah, most of my family lives in Dayton. I have a pretty big family. I have about 8 siblings.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. We had 6 in my family, but 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. are they all, are you all close?
Well, see, me and I have a twin sister, but, besides my relationship with her, my other siblings are a little older.
Okay.
And so we're not too close, but yeah.
Yeah. What else would you like our listeners to know about you?
That's a great question. I think I'm really excited and, you know, honored to be able to take on the role as the new editor and producer here at the station. And yeah, it feels like a pretty much like a full circle. Like I remember stepping into Luke's office my first time interning, and I came to Antioch not even knowing what it is that I wanted to do. But my first internship as a Miller Fellow here at WISO kind of like guided my steps into what it is that I wanted to pursue at school, and then now like as a career. And so yeah, remember stepping into Luke's office and saying, like, I want to do this when I graduate. He's like, okay, just stick around. And so I stuck around, and so I'm happy to be here. And yeah, everyone on the team has always been so supportive and you know, welcoming and very good advocates and mentors. So yeah, it feels like home here.
That's great. And it's exciting to have direction at such a young age, and the possibilities are really endless for you. So congratulations on becoming a full-time staff member here at WISO. You're doing really great work, and I appreciate you sitting down for some conversation.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me, Jerry.
This is Bird Note. The tide's partway out. Bonaparte's gulls, one of North America's smallest, have formed a chorus line at the water's edge. Side by side, in half an inch of water, they're stomping their feet as fast as they can. This stirs up an abundance of tiny marine invertebrates, including a smorgasbord of shrimp. Is this a learned behavior, Or are the gulls born knowing how to forage cooperatively? Most likely, it's innate, but no one knows for certain. The Bonaparte's gulls have returned from the boreal forest of the north, where they nest in trees. Trees? Yes, they're the only gull that regularly does that. Now, as they migrate south through the Mississippi Flyway and along both coasts, they're amassing in large flocks. The head of the adult is still black, like a vanilla cone that's been dipped in very dark chocolate. But soon, it will begin a gradual transition back to the white head of winter. This is one gull you're never going to see in a garbage dump. Bonapartes find food in several ways, but not by picking through trash. Why should they, when they have such a nutritional dance routine? To share today's show with a friend, begin at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Bird Note, putting a wrap on this edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for sharing your weekends with WISO. We've got more highlights and conversations for you next weekend. Please join us then. Our theme music is Another Beautiful Day in Paradise by Magnolia Bolthead to play us out.